Today, I want to speak about a topic I don't really know anything about. I don't understand it, actually, even though I've tried really hard. And you might think, what's new? But I've tried hard every day, and you'd think that I would have shown more progress by now. Now, I'm not alone in this. It's not just me that doesn't know anything about this topic and doesn't really understand it. I would say about half the people in this room exhibit the same level of understanding as I do. What is that topic? What do you think it is? That topic is women. It's like, ooh, dangerous ground. I know all about it. Yep, that's right. All my life, I've been surrounded by lots of women. I have 5 sisters. And I now live with 3 blonde cheerleaders and a rabbit that's also a girl. That's it. But it's been great. But I don't know anything about it. I try to understand, right? And I would say most men here would say they try as well. But one thing I have learned, I only plan to speak about positive things. So, I do have a qualifying statement. I'm only going to say it once, but I really want you to hear it. Please don't take any offense. None is intended. Now, there are many references to influential women throughout the Bible, and frankly, there are many influential women and very solid women in this congregation of all ages. And the reason I thought about this is, we'll get to it in a second, is that there are a lot of references, obviously in the Bible, to women, a lot of them by name, and a lot of them, it just has a particular phrase or a phrase that sounds similar. We'll get to it in a second. But women wield a lot of influence. If we even think of the church in the last few years, you think about all the things we've heard about. Even Mr. Franks, when he speaks, he talks about his mother being the first member in that area 10 or 12 years before his father. Now, that story, I've heard that story, not just from him, but from many others. Women are the anchor in a lot of churches. They're very strong. We don't focus in on them a lot. And I'm sure that I will get in trouble in some degree today. But women do wield a lot of influence in this country and around the world. And I've seen this a lot in my work. And it was pretty easy. I've always said that, in promoting consumer products, that women make, I always said, 75% of the purchase decisions, and they probably influence 90%. I was actually wrong. It's higher than that. This is from Fast Company. Quote, women are the next global emerging market. Their economic power is truly revolutionary, representing the largest market opportunity in the world. Just look at the numbers. Women control 65% of global spending and more than 80% of U.S. spending. There's so many jokes there. I'm not going to tell any of them. But I'm serious about this too, though. But by 2014, the World Bank predicts that the global income of women will grow by more than $5 trillion. $5 trillion U.S. dollars. In both emerging markets and developed nations, women's power of influence extends well beyond the traditional roles of family and education to government, business, and the environment. It's true. And I've quoted this many times to clients that women control 70 make 75% of the purchase decisions. I was wrong; it's higher than that. But I always qualified it and say that they influence probably even more, a higher percentage. And you just think about what it is. And I know no offense is intended in this at all. But you think about it. We need to get the deck fixed. We need to get the deck fixed, right? Well, that the man may go and buy that, but he's been influenced to get the deck fixed, right? So it's even higher than 75%. Women wield a lot of power. Now, what does the Bible tell us? This phrase, and it appears a few times in a similar way, but I'd like to show you about this, a general description of women. Let's go to Acts 17. I'd like to show you something here, and maybe you've seen it or just read over it, but it's something that is very interesting, but it's also telling. Acts 17, and we'll start in verse 10. And it's talking about women, but kind of in passing. This is some of Paul's journeys. Verse 10, it's about Paul and Silas going to Berea. We've read this many times, I'm sure. But Acts 17, verse 10, then the brethren immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. When they arrived, they went into the synagogue of the Jews. These were more fair-minded than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness and searched the scriptures daily to find out whether these things were so. Therefore, many of them believed, and also not a few of the Greeks, prominent women as well as men. Prominent women. Just we glance over it there, and we say prominent men as well. But when the Jews from Thessalonica learned that the word of God was preached by Paul at Berea, they came there also and stirred up the crowds. But the prominent women believed. And you'll see this phrase and phrases like leading women. And often it's a nameless crowd. But the men are nameless here too, right? But women hold a lot of influence. Now that's not a surprise to any of us, right? It's definitely not a surprise to the women. And it's not a surprise to the men. But this is, in this case, it's a good example. Let's go back a few pages to Acts 13. Acts 13, verse 49. Acts 13, verse 49. And the word of the Lord was being spread throughout all. Now, let me give you a little bit of background to this. This whole passage here is really interesting. It's not related to this phrase here, other than it's part of it. But this is an interesting thing if you want to read it at some point. This is a brief history of the nation of Israel all the way up until the coming of Jesus. Really interesting in a very short verse there. But verse 49, we pick it up. And the word of the Lord was being spread throughout all the region, but the Jews stirred up the devout and prominent women and the chief men of the city, raised up persecution against Paul and Barnabas, and expelled them from their region. So sometimes it was not for good, it was for bad. But prominent women influence a lot. And we don't always talk about it. But women are very, obviously, very important in the plan of God. Now, we can't go really too far in this topic. And I knew that I could probably get your attention because you're waiting for me to really offend somebody, aren't you? Because, well, I don't intend to. And I don't think I will. Let's go to Proverbs 31. Proverbs 31, in verse 10, Proverbs 31, verse 10, why is it important? Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. I love rubies. If you look at my wife's wedding ring, it has a ruby in it. I think it's beautiful. The blue rubies are beautiful too. But her worth is far above rubies. Verse 11. The heart of her husband safely trusts her. Trust her. That's something that's lacking in our society today, is trust. So he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. So is this just about women? Who's going to be the bride of Christ, right? So this message is not just about women and for women. It's for all of us. It's for all of us, as we all will be the bride of Christ. Today I'd like to focus on lessons from three women written about in the Old Testament. Now there are a lot of women that we could read about in the New Testament as well, but I've chosen three in the Old Testament. There's stories there preserved for us, for what I submit to you is more than just historical reference. So let's review. What I'd like to do is review succinct traits that they exhibited, left as examples for all of us, women, men, young and old. And I do hope our young people, men and women, might find it helpful too. But thinking of what kind of wife that you might like to be blessed with in the future, and examples for the women. But also these traits can go across men and women. But these examples are set here for us, I believe, for more than just historical reference. Now, I'm focusing just on three, but there are nearly 200 women mentioned by name in the Bible. I could have highlighted many others, including Abigail, right? Remember Abigail? Hannah, who was the mother of Samuel. We hear a lot about Samuel, but the story of Hannah is really inspiring. Miriam, Moses' sister. Mr. Black actually referenced her. She was powerful too. I mean, she was there. She gave a lot of counsel to Moses. She was not perfect. Of course, Sarah, Mary and Martha. Martha gets beat up a lot in a lot of messages you think about, but there's a lot about her, and she exhibited a lot of great traits. Elizabeth, who was the mother of John the Baptist. Rahab, of course. Lois and Eunice, who were the mother and grandmother of Timothy. And of course, Rebecca. And so the list goes on, but I've chosen three, just three. And the first one I'd like to talk about, I'd like to kind of paint the time period first. When Joshua took the Israelites into the Promised Land, and after he died, there was a period there between Joshua and the time of Saul of about 400 years, right? And that was called and referred to now as the time of Judges. It was about 400 years, and what would happen, Israel would swing between being somewhat obedient to God and showing honor toward God, to the other end, to worshiping foreign gods, making idols, breaking the Sabbath, and not showing honor toward God in any way. And so when they would get really bad, a judge would be sent in. Now, during this time, there were approximately, and I say approximately, 12 judges, because some of them were like, well, were they a military leader or a judge, right? So it's approximately 12 judges, and they were all men except one. Just think about a woman in the land of Israel. You think, were there not any decent men, or was she so astounding that she was chosen by God as a judge? Perhaps it was a bit of both. Let's go to Judges 2. I'd like to show here that God actually talks about and tells us that he set up the judges. Well, this is going to be embarrassing if I can't, I'm not finding, here we go. Joshua and then Judges. Judges 2, and we'll read here starting in verse 16. Judges 2, verse 16, and it says, the title of this section of my Bible says, God raises up deliverers. Verse 16 of chapter 2, nevertheless, the Eternal raised up judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them. So they would also, when they were having a lot of these troubles, they would be attacked and persecuted by peoples from around them. Verse 17, yet they would not listen to their judges, but they played the harlot with other gods and bowed down to them. They turned quickly from the way in which their fathers walked in obeying the commandments of the Eternal. They did not do so. And when the Eternal raised up judges for them, the Eternal was with the judge and delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Eternal was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who oppressed them and harassed them. And it came to pass when the judge was dead that they reverted and behaved more corruptly than their fathers by following other gods to serve them and bow down to them. They did not cease from their own doings nor from their stubborn way. This is the time frame we find this one female judge. And I know we know who she is, but this is the story of Deborah. And Deborah, the story of Deborah is captured in one chapter, Judges chapter 4, but it's also captured again in a poem in Judges chapter 5. So as we read the story of Deborah and we think about her, I'd like to have you focus on three characteristics that she had. First of all, she was obviously a wise woman. So wisdom, and wisdom is that tool that we use to make good decisions, right? She made wise decisions. She had a lot of wisdom. And she also, as we'll see, had a lot of courage. And that courage would be symbolized by the leadership that she showed. And also, she had faith. she had faith. So wisdom, courage, and faith. And what I'd like to point out is that the other two examples, one of the traits that they do have in common is courage. Courage, bravery in the face of danger, and the wherewithal to actually have some will of their own, as well as the strength from God. But wisdom, courage, and faith. And it's a story of Deborah. Now, when I read this, just think of the examples of her. First of all, the story that of Deborah has four episodes, right? So four parts of the story. The first one, Deborah, as a judge of Israel, summons Barak. Barak. Now, Deborah was a prophetess. She was a speaker of wisdom. But when war came, she led the outnumbered and badly equipped Israelite troops to great victory. Now, who was attacking Israel was Jabin, the king of Canaan, and he had been persecuting the Israelites for years. And they were all, it was kind of a loose confederation of Israelites. And it was really a David and Goliath situation. And she chose the most able military general and told him what he must do. And she gave him instructions. And we'll see that. But she chose him as well. That's the first scenario. The second scenario is the actual battle. When the general from the Canaanites, Sisera, the Israelites actually soundly defeated them on the field. Now, it's not in the story here, but some scholars think that Deborah also was the genius mind behind luring the Canaanites with their chariots, hundreds of chariots, into the marshes, and they became stuck. Now, I don't find that in the Bible, but that's kind of the tradition. And then, when they beat them, Sisera fled. And there's another story here. When Sisera fled, he fled into a tent of some other Gentile peoples. He fled into a tent of a woman named Jael. And it's actually one of the more gruesome depictions of killing someone that's in the Bible, and it was by the woman Jael. And then, of course, the mother of Sisera, if we know the story, was waiting for him to return, and of course he didn't return. So what I'd like to read this story. It doesn't take long, but I'd like to just think about, if we would, when we read it, looking for examples of wisdom and courage and faith that was exhibited by Deborah. And we think about it, and these are traits that we would all like to have, and in many ways, godly traits. Judges 4, we'll read this here. And so Ehud was also a judge here. And it starts off, when Ehud was dead, the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Eternal. So the Eternal sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who dwelt in Harosheth Hagoyim. And the children of Israel cried out to the Eternal, for Jabin had 900 chariots. So it really was a David and Goliath kind of situation. 900 chariots of iron. For 20 years he had harshly oppressed the children of Israel. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. So unusual. And I've often wondered, well, what did they think? Because up until that time, it had always been men who had led them. But here was a woman who was very strong, very wise, and she seemed fairly comfortable in her job. Verse 5, and she would sit under the palm tree of Deborah, so she had a tree named after her as well, apparently, between Ramah and Bethel in the mountains of Ephraim, and the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. Then she sent and called for Barak, the son of Abinoam. So she called for Barak. She chose this worthy general, and he was from Kadesh in Naphtali, and said to him, has not the Eternal God of Israel commanded, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor? Take with you 10,000 men of the sons of Naphtali and the sons of Zebulun. Now, I don't know the details of why that is, but she chose them, and they intended, most of the camp of Naphtali and Zebulun were together, and they were kind of in the middle of how the Israelites had camped, right? But they were right in the middle of that, and they were near each other. And against you I will deploy Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his multitude at the river Kishon, and I will deliver him into your hand. And Barak said to her, if you will go with me. I was like, she must have been something else, right? Barak, by the way, he's going to have 10,000 men, and God's going to be with him. He said, well, if you'll go with me. The example she must have, and the charisma she must have exhibited as well. He said, if you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. So she said, I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, there will be no glory for you. Right? She goes, if I have to go with you, then you're not going to get any of the credit. There will be no glory for you in the journey you are taking, for the Eternal will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. So this is a prophecy as well. So it's really selling it into her hand, but the actual person who kills Sisera is actually a woman too. So it's a prophecy as well. Then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. And Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh. He went up with 10,000 men under his command, and Deborah went up with him. Now Heber the Kenite of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, right, because Moses had married his wife was from the tribe of Moab, had separated himself from the Kenites and pitched his tent near the terebinth tree at Zaananaim, which is beside Kadesh. So what was the result? So just think now, Deborah has called it. She's said, if I go with you, I will. And, you know, all indications are, at least by tradition, is that she actually laid out the battle plan. And so she went with him, and they reported to Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor. So Sisera gathered together all his chariots, 900 chariots, and all the people who were with him. And Deborah said to Barak, verse 14, up, for this is the day in which the Eternal has delivered Sisera into your hand. She's still giving directions, a strong, courageous woman. Has not the Eternal gone out before you? So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. And the Eternal routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. So she organized the battle. She called it. And she actually participated in it as well. And we'll skip a lot of this story. What happens is Jael actually takes a tent peg. She lures Sisera into the tent because he's running. All of his soldiers are dead. And she lures him in there. And as he's tired from the battle, she takes a tent peg and a hammer. And she nails him to the ground through his head. So a very, very violent death that he ended. But it also fulfilled the prophecy that he was delivered into a woman's hand. And it says here in verse 23, so on that day God subdued Jabin, king of Canaan, in the presence of the children of Israel. And the hand of the children of Israel grew strong and stronger against Jabin, king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan. And so the story of Deborah is very brief, but of all the judges over 400 years, one woman, and she exhibited great wisdom. They came to her every day. And she also exhibited a lot of courage. She went into the battlefield and by tradition planned the battle. And she had faith that God would deliver all of Israel from the hand of the Canaanites. And that's all we hear about her. Now there are, you know, a couple of other references about her, but we don't hear anything else about her. But what a story and what a woman. And it's a celebration, I think, of here that it's like, you know, the story was one, but we're not going to get by with just that, right? There's a poem and a song that's all of chapter 5. We won't read that because it tells the story again and a very beautiful piece of literature. But that's the story of Deborah. She exhibited faith and trust in God, and she showed courage and leadership in the face of grave danger to herself. She also showed wisdom every day, not just during the time of battle. So Deborah is the first example, and we think about her and we celebrate an example of strong women that God uses. Now the second example I'd like to focus on was also during the time of Judges. And a story we've heard many, many times. We've heard it scores of times, no doubt. And it's about a woman for whom one of two books are named in the Bible. And so you could guess, right? You know, it's probably what it is. Now, the lessons about this woman are really about loyalty. We think about loyalty, and we think, why would we have a lesson about that? And if we think about what God is nothing, I mean, that's a central feature of God's character, and a trait that he wants in all of us is loyalty to him. And this woman exhibited this. She also, and we'll focus on loyalty mainly, but she was also resourceful, and she heeded wise counsel. So loyalty, resourcefulness, and she heeded wise counsel. Now, just focusing on three, she was also very courageous, as we'll see. But the story hinges on loyalty. Her name even shows this, as it is a short, her name is short for lovely friend. A lovely friend. So it's, again, loyalty, a trait highly valued by God the Father and Jesus Christ. And who is that woman? Well, Ruth is short for Ritut, which means lovely friend. And Ruth, we've heard so many stories about her, we know it. We're not going to read the whole story. But again, different episodes of the story of Ruth. And we know the story. We could probably tell it pretty comfortably to one another and other people. But the first part is that Naomi and Ruth go back to Bethlehem. Now they had, Naomi and her husband and sons had fled. They were Israelites. They had fled Israel during a famine into the land of Moab, where Ruth was from. And Ruth and another woman named Orpah had married Naomi's sons. We know the story. And they had, Naomi and Ruth had suffered terrible misfortune. Their men in the family, including both their husbands, had died. And they were essentially marooned in Moab. And the older woman, Naomi, decided to return to her home in Bethlehem. And Ruth, though she was a Moabite, decided to go with her. And she pledged her loyalty to Naomi, and they set out on the long journey, arriving in time for the barley harvest. So we know the story. And then, of course, one of the great love stories in the Bible. Ruth meets Boaz. And soon after, after entering, Ruth did meet Boaz, a rich landowner and a relative of Naomi. And it seems to have been love at first sight for him. And we immediately start showing her favor. And he ordered that Ruth be well treated when she worked in his fields. And the older woman, Naomi, saw immediately what had happened. And Naomi was very cunning. The story is really about Ruth, but Naomi had a lot of wisdom. And Ruth heeded her counsel. And we'll see that a lot. That's a really key character trait, that Ruth was willing to listen to wise counsel. And Naomi encouraged Ruth to continue working in Boaz's fields, no one else's. And then Ruth has a lot of spunk, right? She actually proposed to Boaz. And again, shrewdly, this is the third episode here. Ruth proposes marriage. Shrewdly, Naomi advised the young woman how to catch Boaz. She approached Boaz during the night at the threshing floor. And that was a very typical thing. During the harvest season, people would sleep with the grain so no one would steal it. And so it wasn't unusual that they would sleep with the grain. And Ruth actually approached him and suggested that they marry, reminding Boaz of his obligation to her as her nearest male kin. Now this was at the advice and the counsel that Naomi gave her. And she heeded that counsel. And obviously Boaz promised to do all that he could. And then of course the happy ending, Ruth and Boaz marry. And Naomi's plan succeeded. Boaz proved as good as his word, and he and Ruth were married. And we know the story. She had a son called Obed, and Naomi became the nurse for that baby. And Obed grew up to become the grandfather of King David. So is the story just about Ruth? King David had other great-grandmothers. He had other women in his lineage. But we have a story about Ruth, and it's really about loyalty. Loyalty is very important to God. And I've mentioned it before, but I think it's really an astounding way that God shows his character through a word called Hesed. Hesed is throughout the Old Testament, and it pictures God's loyalty, that it's consistent, and it's often translated in the word mercy. So I'd like to go there first. Hold your place. Actually, we'll come back to Ruth here in a minute, but let's go to Psalm 136. Psalm 136. Psalm 136, verses 1 to 9, and we think about Hesed, and I know I've spoken about this, but it's striking to me how much it appears throughout the Bible. And it talks about God's loyalty. And we'll read just the first few verses of Psalm 136. Oh, give thanks to the Eternal, for he is good. His mercy endures forever. His loyalty, his mercy, his loyalty. God keeps his word. He keeps his word. Verse 2, O give thanks to the God of gods, for his mercy endures forever. O give thanks to the Lord of lords, for his mercy endures forever. It goes on this way. Verse 4, to him who alone does great wonders, for his mercy endures forever. His loyalty, his consistent love, he keeps his word. Verse 5, to him who by wisdom made the heavens, for his mercy endures forever. To him who laid out the earth above the waters, for his mercy endures forever. To him who made great lights, for his mercy endures forever. The sun to rule by day, for his mercy endures forever. The moon and stars to rule by night, again, for his mercy endures forever. And it goes on. And this is just one verse, one chapter. Loyalty is very important to God. Let's go back to Ruth. Ruth is right after the book of Judges, and I want to focus on probably the key verse, and we've heard it many times, but what is the key verse of Ruth, and what is it that we can learn from the book of Ruth, and from Ruth herself? Ruth chapter 1, verse 16, we've heard it many times, but Ruth said to Naomi, when Naomi essentially set her free, what did she say to her? Ruth said back, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Eternal do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. Now just think about that message of loyalty that she showed and what we can learn from that we can be loyal to God. That's what God wants, and he is loyal to us. It's a really important principle, and it's a key verse, not only in the book of Ruth, but it summarizes Ruth's loyalty, and its example preserved very prominently for us, and we pay attention to it because she became the great-grandmother of King David, who will rule all of Israel. This woman who was a Moabitess, right? But she exhibited loyalty that God wants to show to us. But, you know, it also shows us other examples too here in Ruth chapter 2, verse 22. She was also humble enough to listen to wise counsel. Verse 22 of chapter 2. And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, Boaz's young women, and that people do not meet you in any other field. In other words, stay with him. She was giving her very wise counsel. So she stayed close by the young women of Boaz to glean until the end of barley harvest and the wheat harvest, and she dwelt with her mother-in-law. Verse 1 of chapter 3, then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? Now Boaz, whose young women you were with, is he not your relative or our relative? In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Therefore, wash yourself and anoint yourself. Put on your best garment and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking." This sounds really bad, right? But we'll see this exact same thing again. Food and wine play a big part in getting along with men. We'll see. It's true. Well, in the next example, we'll see it as well. But it wasn't right as soon as he came in. It was after he came in and he had eaten a meal and he had had a glass of wine. I don't think it's a coincidence. I mean, just, you know, again, you can ask women, you can ask all the men. It's a better way afterwards. And the next example is a really prominent example of how important food is. And then it says, verse 4, "Then it shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go in, uncover his feet, and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do." And she said to her, "All that you say to me, I will do." She heeded that. So not only was Ruth loyal, but she heeded advice as well. So the story of Ruth shows us that Ruth was resourceful. I mean, she was very resourceful. And she went out to glean. Now, of course, the lesson is really about loyalty primarily. It's also about listening to wise advice. But the fact that she went out to glean is that she was giving efforts for God to bless. And I really believe that. She didn't sit still. She was resourceful. She felt she had to go out and actually do something. She made an effort, something for God to bless. And how important was that example? Again, she became the great-grandmother of King David. That example preserved from what would seem to be an irrelevant woman who was a Moabitess, but she became the grandmother, the great-grandmother of King David. And I think the lesson here is not only all of her character, but her loyalty really, really stood out. So the next example, and the third example here today, is an example of faith, and it's an imperfect faith. We have that too, right? The next example, the final example here that we'll spend some time on, was an example of faith, but it was wavering at first. We have that too. But it also showed courage. Again, courage seems to be something that does kind of go across all these examples and many others. And she also had wisdom. This woman, this third person we'll talk about. So she had faith, courage, and wisdom. And her wisdom in particular was related to patience. So patience can be a part of wisdom. Now the time frame of this particular woman is much later, probably 500 or 600 years later, still an Israelitish woman. She was from the tribe of Judah. But she was much, much later than Deborah and Ruth, well after the time of the judges. In fact, it was after the time of Saul and David and Rehoboam and Jeroboam. It was to the point, actually, it was after Judah went into captivity, and many of the Jews had already come back to rebuild the temple. But not all the Jews came back. Some of the Jews, and many of them, stayed in Persia because Persia had overrun the Babylonian Empire. And many of the Jews stayed there. And the setting is in the palace of the Persian king. And of course, we were talking about Esther, she was an orphan, a Jewish orphan. But the interesting thing about the book of Esther, that there's no mention of God. I'm sure you've seen that, but there's no mention of God in the book of Esther. And it's caused many biblical scholars to actually question whether it should be in the Bible or the canon. But guess what? It wasn't their choice. We have the example of Esther for not only us, not just for the example to women, but also to men. And it's the second book named for women. So, of course, we've talked about Ruth And now we talk about Esther, who became the queen of Persia. A young Jewish orphan girl was in the palace of the king of Persia and became the queen. And so the people in Esther's story, we know the story pretty well, and the example is astounding. Her example of faith and courage, and that faith was wavering at first, but she came through. She was the people in Esther's story, Esther was obviously a beautiful young Jewish orphan, and she becomes wife of the Persian emperor. Her cousin, Mordecai, some people refer to him as her uncle, but he was actually her cousin. He was also a Jew during this time, and he took care of her. And he urged Esther in this story to use her influence for the benefit of others. And so one of the things we see in all these stories is that it was always to the service of others. We think of Deborah. All these things she exhibited was always in the service to others. It was every day that was her job. Ruth was the same. It was the service to her mother-in-law. And of course, Esther was it to all the Jewish people throughout the Persian Empire. And of course, the other character, the two other characters, was the king himself, Ahasuerus. He was the Persian king. And then, of course, Haman, who was the chief minister and advisor to the king. And he was from the tribe of, he was an Amalekite. And the Amalekites, if we look through all the Old Testament, we'll see that the Amalekites were a vicious tribe of Edom, a vicious tribe of Edom. And of course, the kind of a minimal character was the queen Vashti. Now, the word Haman, and a lot of Jewish people today, in fact, there's a festival called Purim that Jewish people observe today based on the story of Esther. And the Jewish people take the example of Haman in a very, very personal and negative way. And I'll tell you a story. I actually worked with a man once in Virginia, and his first initial, I won't tell you his whole name, but his first initial was H, and his last name was Amon. So we actually changed our email address, and his client, one of his clients was Jewish, and the email address we went to was the first initial of our name and our last name. So all of a sudden, this man's name was, his email was Haman at so-and-so. The client was deeply offended. He said, I really would like you to change your email address. The anger that people still have about Haman, who wanted to destroy all Jewish people, is still alive and well today. So those are the characters. And what happened was the Persian emperor banished his queen, Vashti, and put her out of the palace. And he was actually, you think about the way he kind of judged and ruled by whim. And because she wouldn't come out and so he could show her off to his drunken friends, he banished her. Well, he needed a new queen. And of all things, they held a beauty contest, right? So we know the story. And who won this beauty contest? After a few months of the spa treatments, this young Jewish girl named Esther was chosen. And she was helped by her cousin Mordecai. But as they grew up, Mordecai became an enemy of Haman. We know the story. And under Haman's influence, the king, unknowingly and unwittingly, had decided to execute all Jews. And as Mordecai went to Esther, we can read this in the first few chapters. We'll just talk about it here. But Mordecai went to Esther and told her that she must do something. She did not want to, because it would place her own life in danger. So she wavered. She wavered about whether she should do something. But the key verse, and we'll go to it in just a few minutes, is actually in Esther 4. Actually, let's go there now. So we'll see the key verse here. So I've set the stage, and we won't read the whole thing because it is quite a long story. I know that one of these days I'm not going to find one of these books. Here it is. It's a small book after the book of Nehemiah. We'll read the story of Esther and really get to the crux of it here. So all of the Jewish people, the edict came down that all Jewish people would be killed. And of course, like us, there was a lot of panic, among all the Jewish people. And so we go to Esther 4, and we'll read a bit of the story here. Esther 4, we'll start in verse 1. So we've set the stage. When Mordecai, verse 1, learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes and he put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city. He cried out with a loud and bitter cry. And he went as far as the front of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. And in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping, and wailing. No mention of God in any of the book, but there's always a reference to it. There's fasting. There's fasting. Why would they fast? They wanted God's hand. And many lay in sackcloth and ashes. In verse 4, so Esther's in the palace, right? Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her, and the queen was deeply distressed. Then she sent garments to clothe Mordecai and take his sackcloth away from him, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, whom he had appointed to attend her, and she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the city square that was in the front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that had happened and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given at Shushan, that he might show it to Esther. Esther was cocooned inside the palace, and he asked that it be explained to her, and then he might command her to go into the king and make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. So Hathach returned and told Esther the words of Mordecai, and Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a command for Mordecai. So she wavered at first, but all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court of the king who has not been called, he has but one law: put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. She's scared. We would be scared too. She knew that even the queen was not allowed to go. She would be killed. So they told Mordecai Esther's words. What did Mordecai say? He sent back to her. And it's the reference here, not mentioning God by name, but just read what he says. And Esther told them to answer. Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews." She kept her identity secret. "For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place." So it's a reference that God, look, you know, is this a coincidence that she's there? And essentially, Mordecai is saying, you're there for a reason. And if you don't do it, another way will come. So it is about a coincidence, but really, is it a coincidence? Is she there to save the people? All indications are that's why she was there. But he put her in her place, and she was wavering, but she was convinced. And then he said, "You and your father's house will perish." In other words, you're an orphan, and if you die, all of your father's family will cease. You're the last one. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Are we at that? Do we ever come to that point? Do we know when those times come to us? It's very poignant. And Mordecai moved her and stirred up her faith like we can be stirred up. But she had been wavering. Her faith came through, but it wasn't strong at first. Verse 15, then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai. Here's the key verse. Here's the key verse where she really comes into her own, and we can come to our own as well. And someday we may have to. Maybe we already have. Verse 16, she says, "Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me." And she was fasting too. "Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day." I'm sure many of you fasted more than one day. It's not easy. If you've not done it and you have the courage to do it at some point, it's not an easy thing. To fast for 3 days is not easy. And she asked them, and when she was doing all of this, she was still fasting. So we think about what she's doing. "My maids and I will fast likewise," she said. "And so I will go to the king," which is against the law, mind you. And here's the kicker, the key verse. "And if I perish, I perish. If he kills me because I go in, it's against the law, so be it." She takes the challenge from Mordecai. Her faith is now stirred up from God, but sometimes we need that. So she came through with faith. And like us, it's not always strong right away. "So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him." It's a great example of faith for us. It won't always be automatic. It won't always be automatic. But then let's go to chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 1. "Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace across from the king's house. While the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house. So it was when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, which was against the law, she had not been bidden to come, that she found favor in his sight." She must have been astoundingly beautiful. But she was also fasting. She had God with her now, right? "And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter." So there it was, right? That means she's not going to be killed. So is that when she asked him? No. There's some food and wine that has to be involved here, right? So this is the wisdom. It's a really interesting here, actually. Let's hold our place there, so I don't lose my place. So we'll put that. Let's go over to Proverbs. I'd like to show you there's wisdom here that she exhibits that we can learn. It's not an easy thing to learn, but it's actually, I thought about including this verse in our session for next week on the Family Club. Why would I do that? Proverbs 15, verse 28. "The heart of the righteous studies how to answer. The heart of the righteous studies how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked pours forth evil." She knew that was too early to ask. So she's standing before the king, and he holds out the scepter. That means she's not going to die. So should she ask right away, "Hey, save me and my people?" She doesn't do that. She doesn't do that. What does she do? Let's go back to Esther 5. Esther 5 and verse 2. Actually, we'll go, let's see, to verse 3. Here's her opportunity, but she doesn't take it here. Verse 3, "And the king said to her, 'What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request?' 'It shall be given to you up to half the kingdom.' So Esther answered, 'If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him, food and wine.'" I don't think it's an accident. Verse 5, "Then the king said, 'Bring Haman quickly, that he may do as Esther has said.' So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. At the banquet of wine, the king said to Esther, 'What is your petition?'" So here's her chance, right? Surely. This is when she's going to, he's had food and wine. He thinks it's great. Esther said, "My petition and request is," does she ask? She doesn't. Verse 8, "If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet, which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." A second banquet. So Haman went out that day, joyful and with a glad heart. Why? He was pretty thrilled that he was the only guest, other than the king, that at the banquet that the queen had prepared. But when he left, when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and remember, he couldn't stand Haman, because Haman, the story was, Haman wouldn't bow down to him, this Jew, right? So when he saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him again, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and called for his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Moreover, Haman said, "Besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come in with the king to the banquet that she prepared, and tomorrow I am again invited by her along with the king. Yet all this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." What a story. There are movies made about it because it's a great story. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows be made, 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet." And the thing pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Remember the verse, I forget where it is, talks about people digging pits for others and they end up falling in it themselves? It's exactly what Haman did. It's exactly what he did. Now, then she springs her trap, right? Now she's got it, so she's ready. Chapter 7, verse 1. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther, and on the second day at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, "What is your petition?" Queen Esther, "It shall be granted you. What is your request? Up to half the kingdom, it shall be done." Now she asks, right? She's built up favor. There's a lot of wisdom in that, right? She doesn't immediately ask him when he holds out the scepter. She builds up favor. There's a lot of wisdom. So she's exhibited a lot of faith, a lot of courage in the face of danger, and wisdom. A great example for all of us. Verse 3, then Queen Esther answered and said, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request." So now she asks them. She's built up to it. We're at chapter 7. She could have asked him two banquets ago, but she waited, right? A great example. "For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss." So we know how the story ends. The king revokes the order. The letter is sent to all the Persian Empire. The Jews are not to be killed. And Haman is hanged on the gallows he built for Mordecai. All because of Esther. All because of Esther. So although there's no mention of God in this book, Esther did call for all the Jews to fast, and she fasted herself. She exhibited the right steps, but she also exhibited faith. And Mordecai also referred to God when he told Esther that if she wouldn't get involved in the situation, that another way would be provided. And often that could be for us too. So when that time comes for us, will we waver? We might. But will we remember Esther? Will we remember this example of this prominent woman who actually saved the Jews? And these were all the descendants of Jesus Christ as well, because Christ came from the tribe of Judah. So the lessons from her are faith, but not right away, courage in the face of danger, and wisdom about what to do and how to do it. Three examples of women. There's so many others. So women are so influential. It's a topic I don't understand, but fortunately we have a lot of good examples in the Bible. Deborah, Ruth, Esther, examples not only for women in our congregation, but also the men, that these are examples that we could follow. Loyalty, so important to God. Courage in the face of even physical danger, and courage in small things too, where we may be scared of a situation. The wisdom, and wisdom is, in my view of you read the Proverbs 9 and it talks about the seven pillars of wisdom, wisdom is a tool we use to make good decisions. And these women exhibited that, very strong women. And another thing that these examples had, as I said before, it was all in the service of others. That's, again, God's character. So these godly traits, these women, this topic that might be a scary topic to give, these are godly traits that we are add to our character, not only for women, young and old, but for all of us, all the men as well. Loyalty, courage, wisdom, and faith of these three women, and there's so many other examples, but these are excellent examples that we should emulate as well.